This is VOA News. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts. Reports out of Ukraine tell of shelling taking place in and around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. By all accounts, the situation is under control, according to VOA's Anna Chernikova in Kyiv. She tells Steve Miller of VOA's Flashpoint Ukraine, Ukrainian forces continue so-called counter-offensive actions in the Kherson region.
As a result of the airstrikes, as reported by the armed forces of Ukraine, thousands of Russian soldiers were killed and thousands of ammunition and weapons and equipment was destroyed. This all happens in the territory of the South Front Line. What we also know is that Russian army also continues strikes and attacks in this area, particularly with aviation and artillery.
Chernikova reminds the situation is constantly changing. Look for the latest on voanews.com. As Russia struggles to boost its troop numbers in Ukraine, the military is engaged in a covert recruitment effort. AP correspondent Charles de la Desma explains.
The prisoners at a penal colony in St. Petersburg were expecting a visit by officials. Instead, men in uniform arrived and offered them an amnesty if they agreed to fight alongside the Russian army in Ukraine. As Russia continues to suffer losses in its invasion, now nearing its sixth month, the Kremlin has refused to announce a full-blown mobilization, a move that could be very unpopular for President Vladimir Putin. Instead, there's been a covert recruitment effort that includes using prisoners to make up the manpower shortage. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
For more on these and other stories, download our easy-to-use app. Just search for VOA News. This is VOA News. U.S. President Joe Biden plans to travel across the country to tout a series of recent legislative victories on climate change, gun control, and drug pricing as a win for Americans and a defeat for special interests, White House officials said Thursday. Mr. Biden, whose public approval rating rose this week to its highest since early June, plans to use those victories to rally support for Democrats ahead of the November 8th midterm elections. And gas prices are falling at the pumps in the United States just in time for that last surge of vacation travel before kids head back to school. AP correspondent Jennifer King reports.
AAA says the national average for a gallon of regular gas has fallen to $3.99, and the shopping app Gas Buddy cited an average of $3.98. That's down more than a dollar from mid-June, and the first time it's gone below $4 in 5 months. Motorists in some western states are still paying more. Oil prices have dropped on concerns about slowing economic growth around the world, and the U.S. benchmark for crude oil recently dipped close to $90 a barrel. Republicans are blaming President Biden for high gas prices, while Biden has been sparring with oil companies, accusing them of posting huge profits while not producing as much oil and gas as they could be. Jennifer King, Washington.
A power outage in Toronto's downtown core Thursday left the offices of Canada's top businesses in the dark and forced the evacuation of one of the city's biggest shopping malls. Power utility Hydro One said the outage affected 10,000 customers in downtown Toronto. No cause has been reported yet. The Toronto Stock Exchange said its offices temporarily lost power, but its systems did not. The outage caused some traffic lights to stop working, according to a Reuters witness. China and South Korea clashed Thursday over a U.S. missile defense shield that threatened to undermine efforts by the new government of South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol to overcome long-standing security differences. The disagreement over the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System emerged after an apparent smooth first visit to China by South Korea's foreign minister this week. The Indian capital reintroduced public mask mandates Thursday as COVID-19 cases continue to rise across the country. The New Delhi government reinstituted a fine of 500 rupees or $6 for anyone caught not wearing a mask or face covering in public. Wednesday, New Delhi reported 8 deaths due to coronavirus, the highest in nearly 6 months. And recapping our top story, reports out of Ukraine tell of shelling taking place in and around the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant. By all accounts, the situation is under control, according to VOA's Anna Chernikova, who is in Kyiv. Via remote, I'm Diane Roberts, VOA News.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yeheyes Wuhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight...
We have a population in Tunisia that's exhausted by COVID. It was one of the hardest hit countries in Africa. Exhausted by economic hardship, exhausted by political frustration. And they are sort of waiting for someone to save the day. And many turn to the president, and he's failed so far.
That's William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, on the frustration of Tunisia's people. Details coming up. Also, the U.S. military says it carried out 3 airstrikes north of Somalia's capital, Mogadishu. We'll have these stories and more on Africa News Tonight. But first, our top story. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Rwanda and Democratic Republic of Congo have agreed to begin talks to ease the tension over fighting in eastern Congo. Blinken, speaking in Rwanda today, said he also raised human rights concerns and the detention of U.S. permanent resident Paul Rusesabagina. Sananu Tord reports from Kigali, Rwanda.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken said Thursday the presidents of Rwanda and Democratic Republic of Congo, Paul Kagame and Felix Tshisekedi respectively, have agreed to open direct communications aimed at ending the ongoing tensions in the eastern Congo. The two leaders have accused each other of supporting rebel groups in the chronically volatile region. Blinken, in his address, warned that supporting and cooperating with armed groups will endanger local communities and threaten Central Africa's stability. He urged the two groups to be respectful of each other's territory. Blinken said both Kagame and Tshisekedi welcomed the United States' support and committed to begin processes towards achieving stability.
Both presidents have agreed to engage in direct talks with each other. They're both ready to resume the talks in the context of the Nairobi process with armed groups, and both welcome the continued U.S. engagement in support of African-led mediation efforts.
The Nairobi process was an initiative by the outgoing president of Kenya, Uhuru Kenyatta, that brought the heads of state of East African countries together to find lasting solutions to the disturbances in eastern Congo. Blinken also addressed issues surrounding Rwanda's detention of U.S. permanent resident Paul Rusesabagina, who is credited with saving hundreds of people during Rwanda's 1994 genocide and inspired the film Hotel Rwanda. He said he expressed his candid views to Kagame and will continue to engage on the matter.
We have been clear about our concerns related to Paul Rusesabagina's trial and conviction, particularly the lack of fair trial guarantees. We continue to urge the government to address concerns about the legal protections afforded to him in this case and establish safeguards to prevent similar outcomes in the future.
Rusesabagina was taken to Rwanda under false pretenses in 2020 and sentenced to 25 years in prison on terrorism charges last year. Rwandan Foreign Minister Vincent Biruta said Thursday the government has broken no laws.
This was done lawfully under both Rwandan and international laws. Therefore, Rwanda will continue to abide by our laws and the decisions made by our judiciary, and we would request our partners to respect Rwanda's sovereignty, Rwanda's laws, and its institutions.
Blinken emphasized the U.S. commitments to be equal partners with Rwanda in advancing shared priorities, tackling global challenges, and bettering the condition of the country's citizens. Sena Anutod for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
The Reuters news agency reports at least 21 civilians and 8 police officers were killed yesterday in protests in western and northern Sierra Leone. Reuters says hundreds of protesters threw rocks at the police, who some protesters say fired back with live bullets and tear gas. The crowds were protesting rising food prices and declining living standards. Some called for the resignation of President Julius Maada Bio, who is on a private trip to the United Kingdom. The government imposed a curfew, which began at 3 p.m. Vice President Mohamed Jouled Diallo criticized what he called unscrupulous individuals for the loss of life. The French news agency AFP quotes a government statement saying confrontation was exacerbated by social media incitement of what it called a gullible population with the aim of subverting peace and stability. Authorities in the Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo are searching for hundreds of inmates who escaped from a prison when gunmen attacked the facility Tuesday night. Five people, including two policemen, were killed during the jailbreak in the city of Butembo. Victoria Amunga reports from VOA's Africa News Center in Nairobi, Kenya.
More than 800 inmates escaped from the Kakwanguru Central Prison in the eastern DRC town of Butembo when dozens of gunmen attacked the jail and freed prisoners overnight Tuesday. Reuters reported that only 58 out of 874 inmates remained when the attack was over. Colonel Polo Ngoma, the police boss in Butembo, said Thursday that police have captured about 50 of the escaped prisoners. Ngoma told VOA that some of those captured were hiding with their families while others were inside the homes of friends. He said officers are still searching for many other prisoners on the run. We are working hard to catch them, he said. We are not just sitting. We have to get them back to prison. Authorities say the escapees are dangerous criminals. Most of the inmates in the central prison were jailed for murder and aiding terror groups. Anthony Mwalushai, the spokesman for the DRC's army operations against armed groups, said the Allied Democratic Forces rebel group was responsible for the jailbreak. In 2020, the ADF was linked to a prison break that freed over 1,000 inmates in Beni in northeastern Congo. Victoria Amunga for VOA News, Nairobi.
Mounting attacks from extremists and criminal gangs, including a brazen assault close to the capital, are creating a headache for Nigerian President Muhammadu Buhari as he reaches his last 6 months in office. Last month, according to the French news agency AFP, the Islamic State group's Nigerian affiliate claimed a jailbreak just 20 kilometers from Abuja's international airport, freeing hundreds of prisoners, including 64 extremist commanders. At least 40 worshippers were killed in June in a Catholic church in southwestern Owo State. And last week, five people were killed in Kogi State, in the center of the country, when gunmen opened fire on a bus. Presidential elections are scheduled for next February for a successor to Buhari. The former army general, first elected in 2015 and re-elected in 2019, is scheduled to step down after two terms. One of Buhari's big campaign promises was to end insecurity and the relentless violence, despite hefty investments in the security apparatus, has left him politically exposed. Opposition lawmakers threw down the gauntlet last month, threatening to impeach Buhari if he failed to stem the violence. But the announcement is widely seen as an empty threat, given the ruling party's parliamentary majority. As Tunisia's president, Kais Saied, soldiers solidifies control under a newly passed constitution with no checks and balances on him, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says the Northern African country's dream of self-government is in danger. Austin added, across Africa, those who support democracy and freedom and the rule of law are battling the forces of autocracy, chaos, and corruption. William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, explained these strong statements to VOA senior analyst Mohamed El Shenawi.
It was accurate, timely, and judicious. It was very carefully constructed. And it's true, Tunisians and Africa do face threats of chaos and corruption, although I think for chaos and corruption, that's more Africa-wide. But in Tunisia, the main issue is not chaos and corruption, it's autocracy. And it's true that Tunisia was inspirational. And it's true that democracy is now but a dream. It's gone away in Tunisia, particularly given how little popular mobilization there's been against the president's actions. We have a population in Tunisia that's exhausted by COVID. It was one of the hardest hit countries in Africa, exhausted by economic hardship, exhausted by political frustration. And they are sort of waiting for someone to save the day. And many turn to the president, and he's failed so far. The fact that Austin said it, a defense secretary and not the secretary of state or the White House, I think made the statement a little stronger and a little clearer. I think when he said it after the referendum was really important, where he said it in Europe, talking to militaries from around the world. But he was also indirectly talking to the Tunisian military, who supported the presidentialist coup and power grab of July 2021. And he's speaking to militaries at the national level in Tunisia and regional and globally and saying, militaries must support civilians in their quest for self-government. And that doesn't include shutting down parliaments and putting tanks outside. Now, the Tunisian military followed orders and put the tanks outside. They've been there for over a year. And he's basically saying it's time to withdraw the tanks and time to let the Tunisian people decide how they're governed and not a president with a shuttered parliament with tanks outside.
As Tunisian President Kais Saied solidifies his control of Tunisia under a newly passed constitution with no checks and balance, he will be challenged to deliver on promises of jobs, bread, and stability for citizens. What are the prospects of him delivering on his promises?
Quite low, but first we have to say that the constitutional referendum was illegal and it was boycotted or no voted by 75% of Tunisians. Now, Saied stopped listening to international interlocutors some time ago. And according to my relatively recent meetings in Tunisia at the highest levels, he spends zero time on economics. So if there is any job creation or economic improvement in Tunisia, it won't be the fruit of Saied's labors. It'll be the fruit of others helping improve the Tunisian economy. So on jobs, he has no plan. He hasn't created any jobs. He has no interest in working on jobs, but the Tunisian private sector has the ability to create jobs if they're allowed to. He has no plan for getting bread, but there are efforts underway to get more wheat and grains from the Ukrainian and Russian markets that were blocked, and the efforts of Erdogan to get that moving. And Tunisia, with like Libya and Egypt, were one of the countries most dependent on grains from the Black Sea area. And in terms of stability, I mean, Saied does spend a fair amount of time looking at threats against himself and threats against the government coming from terrorists. But the problem is the longer Tunisian stays a dictatorship, the worse that will get, because Tunisians both inside and outside the country will increasingly turn to terrorism to face the government. So if there's any improvement, it will be from the international economy and, you know, making the economic factors outside Tunisia better for Tunisia, and the bread will get in. But I suspect over time, Tunisia will become more unstable because dictators over time generally have a problem with instability, and that will probably get worse.
That was William Lawrence, professor of political science at the American University in Washington, speaking with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi. 2 days after Kenya's general election, the results for the presidential contest have yet to be announced. How are Kenyans dealing with the delay? Is there tension in the air? These are questions I pose to Vincent Makori, VOA's Africa 54 managing editor, who is in Nairobi closely monitoring the situation.
Well, yes, I made a point of going out to the streets to talk to people about their thoughts and feelings at this time as the results continue coming in. And most of those I spoke to say they are patiently waiting for the official results to be announced by the Electoral Commission Chairman, Mr. Wafula Chebukati. They have no interest in going any other way other than just sit and wait. They have confidence that at the end of the day, the accurate tally will be provided by the Electoral Commission, and at that time, it will be known who has won, who has lost, or we are going for a runoff. The Electoral Commission has up to 7 days since after the election to announce the results. They have that advantage. They can therefore take it all the way to the seventh day. But Mr. Chebukati, the chairman, has clearly stated that it is his intention to have this process concluded as soon as possible, and therefore we should expect an announcement earlier than the 7 days that are provided by the Constitution.
Different media houses are coming up with all kinds of predictions, divergent tallies, and that could inflame claims of rigging, which have sparked violence in past elections. So what are your thoughts on that?
What's happening is actually, they say, the different media houses have the same access and same kind of numbers from the Electoral Commission. It's the way they're tabulating them that gives them the different kind of disparities that we are witnessing. But what the Electoral Commission is saying, don't pay too much attention to the current numbers being given by the different media houses. I mean, there could be bias in terms of which media house kind of has probably a leaning towards a particular political side. Not that they're misleading with those numbers, but they may choose to release a certain number that for a moment seems to favor a particular candidate. But they say at the very end, all those numbers are going to be similar. So the Electoral Commission is saying, please be patient. Wait for the official results from the Electoral Commission, because only the Electoral Commission has the constitutional authority to announce the final votes that were cast for each of the candidates and therefore determine who has won the election.
Vincent, the commission also, I think, said about 65% of registered voters turned out for the legislative, local and presidential elections, which is a big drop from 2017 when voter participation was nearly 80%.
Yes, for sure. The voter turnout was very low. 22 or 21 million people registered to vote and only about 13 million and a few hundreds of thousands went to the polls. That was a very low turnout, which was lower than had been expected. There was an expectation that there will be a low turnout anyway by some percentage, because especially of the younger demographics saying they have no interest, they have no passion, they have no enthusiasm for this election. But it looked like it was even lower. It was lower even in places where it was expected to be way up there. So it's a subject of debate at this moment. People are talking about it, trying to really figure out what happened.
But still, we also have the parliamentary, local elections. Any result on that front?
Yes, the results for the members of parliament, for example, are announced locally. They are not announced at the national level by the chairman of the Electoral Commission. They are announced by returning officers at the local precincts. So those announcements have been going on throughout the day. It's from one corner of the country to the others. So we are not able at the moment to kind of give an actual number as to which party has a majority or looks like it will have a majority in parliament, because the numbers keep coming in rather fast. And so things are going to be changing as we move. Perhaps by tomorrow we have more clarity.
That was Vincent McCorry, VOA Africa 54 managing editor, who is in Nairobi closely monitoring the country's general election. Mali's military government yesterday confirmed Islamist militants killed 42 of its troops last weekend in a sophisticated drone attack and announced 3 days of national mourning. The announcement came the same day that the country's military leader, Colonel Assimi Goïta, spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin about support from the Kremlin. Annie Rasenberg reports from Bamako, Mali.
3 days of mourning were declared on state TV station ORTM in an announcement read by presenter Bemba Sibi.
Three days
of national mourning, starting Thursday at midnight, is declared throughout the national territory in tribute to the civilian and military victims of the terrorist attack perpetrated in Tessit, Sibi says. After an initial death toll of 17 soldiers and 4 civilians announced on Monday, the government updated the numbers to include a total of 42 soldiers killed during the attack in the northern Mali town of Tessit in a statement Wednesday. The statement also said the Sunday attack included the use of drones and explosives, and that the perpetrators carried out clandestine overflight operations and have benefited from major support, including external expertise. Also on Wednesday, the Kremlin announced that Russian President Vladimir Putin discussed possible deliveries of food and fuel to Mali and continuation of Russia-Mali cooperation in a phone call with Malian interim President Assimi Goïta. Mali received several military aircraft from Russia on Tuesday in a ceremony at Bamako's airport. Mali has been fighting an Islamist insurgency for the past decade, with major support from the French army, which intervened in 2013 following the takeover of northern Mali by Islamists. French President Emmanuel Macron announced the withdrawal of French forces from Mali in February after increasing tensions between France and Mali's military government, which took power in a 2020 coup, and concerns over Mali working with Russian mercenaries. Mali has continually denied working with Russian mercenaries, claiming to only work with official Russian instructors. Human Rights Watch and several international media outlets have since reported on allegations of human rights abuses carried out by the Wagner Group, a paramilitary organization with links to the Kremlin. Insecurity in Mali has risen in recent months, with several Islamist attacks carried out against civilian and military targets throughout the country, and an Islamist attack on the country's main military base in Kati, just 15 kilometers from Bamako, in July. Annie Reisenberg for VOA News, Bamako, Mali.
Opposition groups in the breakaway region of Somaliland have clashed with security forces, with an activist saying at least one person was killed. Mohamed Deseni reports from Mogadishu, Somalia.
The clash Thursday took place in Hargeisa, the capital of Somalia's breakaway region of Somaliland, resulting in several casualties. Security forces allegedly shot at protesters who were shouting slogans against the region's president, Musa Bihi Abdi, and demonstrating against the postponement of a presidential election. Ahmed Yusuf Hussein, a leader of a human rights group based in Hargeisa, told VOA in a phone interview that he saw one dead person and 15 wounded people after the clash. He said people, mainly young men and women, were blocking the roads and the soldiers were firing live bullets to disperse protesters. He said he was told that wounded people were transported to hospitals. He said, I have seen a dead man aged between 20 to 30 years old and 9 wounded people, including 3 women. Faisal Ali Warabe is chairman of Somaliland's opposition Wicked Party. He told VOA that security forces brutalized the peaceful opposition protesters. The current administration is putting the republic in a bad situation by refusing to hold the election, he said. He said the lawmakers' constitutional mandate has expired and the president's mandate is set to expire in November. He said he is sorry that they have been forced to protest in the middle of drought, inflation, and loss of livestock. He said the protesters weren't particularly confronting the security forces, but the president sent his security forces to shoot the protesters. He said, there is no worse day for Somaliland than today. VOA contacted Somaliland's information minister and officials in the ruling Kulmiya Party for comment on Thursday's clash, but got no response. Somaliland is a former British protectorate that declared independence from Somalia in 1991, but has not received recognition from the international community. The U.S. Embassy in Mogadishu released a statement Thursday urging Somaliland's ruling and opposition leaders to avoid violence and return quickly to political dialogue. The embassy said failure to reach agreement on election threatens Somaliland's achievements in democratic governance. Mohamed Daisane for VOA News, Mogadishu, Somalia.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyes Wuhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbilia Baro, and our engineer, Joe Gill, thanks for choosing The Voice of America.
Heather Maxwell, host of Music Time in Africa. Join me every Saturday and Sunday for an hour of awesome African music. Wake up, dance this music. Like to stay on top of new music trends, breakout artists, new releases? Maybe you just love the classic styles and artists of the past. or simply the sound and feel of a good beat. Whatever your pleasure, you can get it every week right here on Music Time in Africa. So join me on your local FM station Saturday.